Welcome back to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and physics students from local high schools and beyond. Interns spend 2 weeks working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the prominent physicists who are here. I'm Marisa Walbert, and I'm hosting today's episode, which is being recorded here at the Aspen Center for Physics. Our intern today is Shen Harmon. He is a rising sophomore at Stanford Online High School. He will be interviewing Gordon Boehm. Gordon Boehm is a professor of physics at the University of Illinois. He was educated at Brooklyn Technical High School, Cornell University, and Harvard University. He spent 2 years at the Niels Bohr Institute in Copenhagen, and after a year at the University of California in Berkeley, settled down at the University of Illinois. His interests in physics are wide-ranging, from matter at low temperatures and under extreme conditions of pressure and energy, to ultra-cold atomic physics, astrophysics, nuclear physics, and the history of physics. He is a pioneer in the study of pulsars and neutron stars, and a driver of laboratory studies of ultra-dense matter via ultra-relativistic collisions of heavy nuclei. His current interests include neutron stars and neutrinos from the Big Bang. He is a member of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences and of the American Philosophical Society, and a fellow of the American Academy for Arts and Sciences. He received the American Physics Society Medal for exceptional achievement in research, as well as its Hans Bethe and Lars Unsanger Prizes, and the Eugene Feinberg Memorial Medal. He is an Aspen homeowner and has been a regular participant in the Aspen Center for Physics since the mid-1960s. Take it away, Shen.
Thank you for being here. It's a pleasure to have you.
So let's not start with the heavy physics. Maybe we can start about, you know, let's talk about some of your travels. I hear that you're a big traveler. You've kind of just been everywhere. So tell me about, what's your favorite place you visited in your entire life?
Oh, that's very hard to say. Probably Copenhagen.
Copenhagen,
yeah. Definitely. I was there after I got my PhD, I spent 2 years in Copenhagen and really just fell in love with the place.
Yeah.
And been going back ever since. Physicists generally don't take vacations. we tend to work in nice places.
Yeah.
So most of the travel I do has been associated with conferences, academic visits, visiting university, giving lectures, working with people, and which is very nice because you get to know people locally.
Yeah,
I mean, one of the wonderful things about being a physicist is when you go traveling, you get invited to people's houses, which as a standard tourist is very rare. Yeah.
How do you like the Center for Physics here?
Oh, the Center for Physics has been absolutely marvelous. I mean, all the summers I've been here, which I've lost count, I've just been tremendously productive.
Yeah.
I mean, one wonderful thing about the place is you're not put in little cubby holes.
Yeah.
I mean, you could talk to everybody, get ideas. Tremendous cross fertilization between people here.
Yeah, I know.
And then people are not divided by their specialty.
Yeah.
And I want to say that it's one of, I mean, the Aspen Center for Physics is one of the things contributed by being able to work in so many different fields.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just tell me a little bit about your work. What do you like to do? What are some of the things that you've discovered?
Oh, well, as Marisa pointed out in the introduction, one of the things I love are neutron stars.
Oh, yes.
And way back in the late 60s, it was discovered that certain stars appeared to blink on and off.
Mm-hmm.
And these are actually what are called neutron stars rotating. Mm-hmm. And they are very small. I mean, 20 miles across completely.
But very dense.
And very the densest matter in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, Aspen played a very big role in this because the first astrophysics workshop here was actually on pulsars and neutron stars.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was in the late 60s.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So, and over the years, we had quite a number of workshops here on neutron stars. And we're finally beginning to understand a little bit about it.
Yeah. Why are you so interested in them, you know?
They contain the densest matter in the universe, and the question, what is it like?
Yeah.
I mean, one possibility is, as you squeeze matter, it begins to break down into more fundamental components. Right. So if you squeeze atoms, it begins to form, for example, a metal, where the you have nuclei and electrons running around freely. If you squeeze further, you begin to squeeze the nuclei together. Mm-hmm. And the nuclei are made of neutrons and protons. Mm-hmm. And electrons are in the atoms. Yeah. As you squeeze further, you get a liquid made of neutrons and protons. Mm-hmm. So then the question, what happens if you squeeze even further?
Yeah.
And because neutrons, we know, are made of objects called quarks.
Yeah.
And if you begin to squeeze neutrons and protons together, you get a soup of quarks. Mm-hmm. And recently, there's been some good evidence for the existence of quarks in neutron stars.
Wow.
I mean, it's an idea we began playing with 40 years ago, or more, 50 years ago.
Wow.
Here. And things take time.
Especially in this field.
No, what's been marvelous about neutron stars, though, is since serious work started roughly 1970, mm-hmm. in the last 10 years, there's tremendous amounts of data coming in.
Yeah.
One of the marvelous things about neutron stars is if you have two neutron stars orbiting each other, called the binary neutron star system, as they get closer and closer because they lose energy, eventually they merge together and form some kind of fireball, which is called a kilonova.
Yeah.
And out of this comes heavy elements.
Right.
And one of the great mysteries that appears to be solved by this is, where does the gold in the universe come from? Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody, where does gold from the universe come from? You say, well, Walmart or your favorite jeweler, where do they get it? From mine in South Africa, where do they get it? Eventually, the gold is actually produced in merging, as neutron stars merge together. Mm-hmm. This is a fantastic discovery. You know, you can't look at any gold anymore without thinking that once upon a time those atoms were in neutron stars.
That's so fascinating. Just the entire chain of gold coming from neutron stars to asteroids hitting planets into their gold.
One of the interesting things also I'm learning here is that very likely these binary neutron star collisions are the sources of some of the highest energy cosmic rays in the universe. And it's just a fascinating story that gets better and better every day.
That's very cool. So what about the other work? What about your microscopy? So you're looking at, whatever, huge scale neutron stars, very heavy. From what I understand, you also look at very small, very like, not quantum, but like very cold.
That's an interesting story. Also quite related to Aspen. One of the wonderful things that experimentalists did in the mid-90s was to take cold atoms, really cold at really low temperatures, I mean, from a millionth of a degree above absolute zero, and now we're down to a billionth of a degree above absolute zero. And there one can form what are called Bose condensates, in which the atoms appear to move coherently in unison, all doing exactly the same thing. And that was also something we studied extensively in Aspen. And what was interesting about that is a lot of the physics that we applied to studying dense matter like neutron stars worked perfectly well there.
Wow.
I mean, it was just, in a sense, the same phenomena, but in a completely different arena. Yeah. And that's also been quite wonderful. And it's still going on. We'll have a workshop at the end of this month on cold atoms and cold molecules now.
Wow, that's really cool. What are you looking to discover in those? Just kind of get it colder and colder?
New states of matter. I mean, the thing about the cold atoms is that you have tremendous control over. You can control the number of atoms, the density. You can control how strongly the atoms interact with each other. You can change the kinds of atoms and just kinds of control that you don't have with ordinary materials like normal metals and insulators and such. And so it, from a theoretical point of view, it forces you to think outside the box. I mean, if you say, well, the particle of certain velocity and normal metals, what happens if certain interaction strength, what happens if that interaction strength is much stronger? What do they do? Well, the cold atom people could just turn dial, increase magnetic fields, and change the interaction strength and really study these questions.
So wow.
It's been quite an exciting area as well.
But let's talk about, let's see, what's like a life, like a lifespan of a neutron star? How do the neutron stars form?
How do they form? Ah, oh, it's a very good question. I mean, an ordinary star goes on, and the sun will not form a neutron star, but presumably stars that are heavier than about maybe 8 to 10 times as much as the sun will, over the course of, the, of their evolution, they'll lose a substantial amount of mass to the outside world. But what's left, once the nuclear fuel is burnt out, the stars will begin to collapse.
Right.
And it's what's a very, very paradoxical thing about stars is that they burn energy, they burn nuclear fuel, but they don't explode. And they don't explode for a very funny reason, that as you burn, if you burn a little too much fuel, the star gets bigger, gets cooler. And so it's a regulatory mechanism that keeps it very stable. But eventually it runs out of fuel. And then it begins to collapse and form what is called the supernovas. It collapses and rebounds, and you get wonderful explosions. And they're all over the universe. Probably we see them in our own galaxy at the rate of 1 per century or so,
wow,
roughly. Now, so the supernova ejects a lot of matter, but what's left in the inside is a very condensed, high-density core that can either be a neutron star or be a black hole.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's still a problem. We're not really quite at the stage where we understand the explosion mechanism well enough. But one forms the neutron stars. I mean, there was an interesting supernova in 1987 in the Large Magellanic Cloud, which is a little baby galaxy near our own galaxy, the Milky Way. And there was this supernova in 1987, and so people were looking for evidence, has this formed a neutron star yet? And I think in recent years there's some evidence that the neutron star was formed there.
So what are the conditions? So you said earlier that sometimes it forms a black hole, and sometimes it forms a neutron star.
Yeah.
What are the conditions for it to form a black hole? And is that the only way that black holes form?
Oh, no. I mean, how to form black holes? This is not really my field, but I have some idea. I mean, you form in supernova. You know, if enough... one very interesting question. We don't know how heavy, what the maximum mass of a neutron star could be.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably around 2.5 times that of the sun. And so if more matter falls in, it just forms a black hole. Mm-hmm. That's one way to get a black hole. Another way is through neutron star mergers.
Mm-hmm.
As they merge together, like one of these was recorded in 2017.
Wow.
Fantastic event. What probably was left over is the mass was left over is too heavy to be a neutron star. Two neutron stars merged together and formed this compact thing, and it probably eventually became a black hole.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
That's another route. Yeah. And then, of course, there's the whole question of forming black holes in the very early universe.
Yeah. When there is...
That's a whole other question in itself. Let me tell you a very recent interest. It started during the pandemic. Neutrinos from the early universe. Neutrinos are very light particles, almost with no mass.
Yeah.
Tiny masses of, you know, on the order of a hundredth of that of the electron, or the thousands of that of the electron. In February 2020, COVID's about to close in on us. A very close colleague of mine asked me, we make neutrinos in the Big Bang, and the neutrinos, what happens to them as they come to us? Because neutrinos hardly interact, and so they come sailing to us almost unscathed. And so I sat down at my dining room table, locked in the house for a year and a half, figuring out all the things that can happen. For example, as the neutrinos spin, Mm-hmm. They sort of, as they move, they spin counterclockwise. But that spin, as it goes past the bumps in the bumps of matter in the universe, the things that eventually form galaxies, that will bend the neutrinos, because obviously as a neutrino goes past something that's gravitating, it'll get bent.
Right.
But the spin will get spent not quite as much. So this law that says that for neutrinos, that its rotation must be sort of along the same axis as its momentum, as its velocity, is no longer true.
Wow.
And so those interesting effects to look at there. But what I learned about neutrinos is they're absolutely marvelous. I mean, each of us has within us something in the order of 20 million of these things, which you never think about. Not only that, but at least even though the neutrinos have very, very tiny mass, they're actually, the temperature that they have is small compared to their mass, for at least two-thirds of them. And that means they're moving not at relativistic speeds, the speed of light, but they're moving much slower, more like electrons in a metal.
Wow.
So, I mean, it turns out these absolutely marvelous objects, they're everywhere. The only relic, only thing left over from the Big Bang that has not been processed. I mean, all of the nuclei in us, carbon, and that's all been processed in stars, where we're third, fourth, fifth, nth generation products of stars. And so except for these neutrinos that run around in us, there's no relic of the Big Bang that we actually have within us.
Wow.
So it's an absolutely marvelous story.
Mm-hmm. You know? That's really cool.
So I knew nothing about neutrinos before, but you sit at your dining room table for a year and a half, unable to go out of the house, you learn things.
So you have this recent... When you're trying to study neutrinos, what do you look for? Like, how do you see where they're interacting? How do we know that they exist?
They hardly interact. I mean, there's various evidence from neutrinos producing reactors and stuff of their basic structure as such. But you know, they're the neutrinos from the sun, mm-hmm. which have much more energy than the ones from the Big Bang. But there are far fewer of them than there are from the Big Bang.
Right.
So of all these neutrinos that come from the sun, and sort of for every photon that's made in the sun is basically a neutrino, of order one neutrino that's made as well. These will interact with a human about once every 70 years.
Wow.
It's very, very, very rare. It's very, very hard to eventually be able to detect neutrinos. Now, one of the problems that's thoroughly unsolved is, even though we understand a lot more now about neutrinos from the Big Bang, they've never been detected.
Wow.
We know how to detect them, but there are sort of complications in doing detection that have not been resolved. I mean, the basic problem is we don't know how to measure things like the energy of electrons to very fine accuracy, which you need for such an experiment.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting about that turns out to be a solid-state condensed matter physics problem that needs to be solved. How do you make detectors that can detect fairly high-energy electrons, measure the energy of them with very, very fine accuracy? And that is yet to be worked out. But that's probably the next generation. Yeah.
I'll solve that for you. Mm-hmm. I'll solve it. Mm-hmm.
Good.
I'll find out how to do it somehow.
Yeah.
So we've detected the sun neutrinos, though, right?
Solar neutrinos, yeah.
Yeah. With the weird chamber with the water.
Yeah, I mean, they were first detected in the Homestake mine in North Dakota.
Hmm.
And what was interesting there is that one didn't see the right number of them. We saw something on the order of a third of what should have been seen. And it turns out the neutrinos are very clever. The neutrinos come in three kinds, which are called electron neutrino, muon neutrino, and tau neutrino. Is associated with electron neutrinos associated with electrons, muon neutrinos associated with a heavy form of electron called a muon, meson, and the tau neutrinos are associated with a still heavier object, kind of electron well, the tau particle.
Yeah.
So we're expecting to see all these electron neutrinos come from the sun. And what turns out to be happening is the neutrinos oscillate. They could change their clothes and suddenly come in pretending they're an electron, a muon neutrino or a tau neutrino, and so you wouldn't see them.
Wow.
And so that problem has been studied rather extensively now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after the original detection in the Homestake mine, there's a big Japanese installation called in a mountain called Kamioka. And the experiment is called Kamiokanda, but the NDE is Neutrino Detection Experiment.
Hmm.
And they've done tremendous work in sorting out the neutrinos. They've done wonderful things like neutrinos go through the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
As they go through the Earth, this change dance from one kind to the other, which technically is called neutrino oscillations, is enhanced. You get more oscillations. And so what they study, they don't study neutrinos from looking up at the sun, they study neutrinos at night by looking down through the Earth.
Wow.
And the wonderful things like photographs taken in neutrinos, you aim the camera down. There's no camera, but it's an enormous installation. But you look down through the Earth, and you have a beautiful photograph of the sun. It's sort of a neutrinograph, not a photograph.
Mm-hmm.
But
wow.
It's quite wonderful.
So you were talking about North Dakota.
Yeah.
And what is so significant about North Dakota from anywhere else in the world? Like, what makes it so special?
Oh,
just lucky.
It's a very deep mine.
Okay.
And the advantage of a deep mine is that it's strongly shielded from cosmic rays. Cosmic rays are all these particles that are constantly bombarding the Earth.
Okay.
Now, cosmic rays don't really affect our lives very seriously because of the strong magnetic field of the Earth, which tends to deflect them. There's still lots of cosmic rays coming down, but going through the Earth will shield the apparatus from them. There's a beautiful neutrino detector at the South Pole called Ice Cube, which is roughly one cubic kilometer. Kilometers is like 2/3 of a mile, full of hundreds of detectors in the water. Very immensely pure. And they detect these highest energy neutrinos in the universe. It's quite amazing.
And I guess the only thing I'm curious about is, because didn't they postulate the existence of a neutrino before they actually discovered
That's
one?
That's a wonderful story. Yes, absolutely. Well, an interesting thing in the development of quantum mechanics, which I gave this public talk on last week, one didn't know which of the old rules still were valid. And one question was certainly, is energy conserved? Or can you somehow spontaneously make energy or energy disappear? But they discovered that certain nuclei could do what's called beta decay, radioactive decay, where out came an electron. And if you added up the energies, some energy was missing. So in the early 30s, Wolfgang Pauli, who's a marvelous Swiss-German physicist, postulated the existence of this particle called the neutrino.
Wow.
He didn't call it the neutrino. That was Enrico Fermi eventually called it the Italian name. It's a diminutive of a neutron. like you call a cell phone, not a telephone, but a telefonino. it's neutrinos, and that was not discovered until the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
The first actual measurements, detection of the neutrino. But everybody firmly believed it was there. Over the years, but we've discovered there are not simply one kind of a neutrino, but there are three,
right?
Plus anti-neutrinos as well.
Which are we?
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you. Wonderful. Thank you so much again for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this Radio Physics. For more information about our internship program and events at the Aspen Center for Physics, please visit our website at aspenphys.org or follow us on social at Aspen Physics.